So an author, a trainer, and a data scientist walk into a podcast, and you get PM 4.0, who knew? Hello, my PMs, and welcome back to our third UMD PM Symposium teaser episode. Here with me are co-host and PM glitterati, Mike Cannon. How you doing, Mike?
Doing great, Kendall.
Where are you calling in from, bud?
Calling in from Bethesda, Maryland, and sometimes you ask me, like, hey, what's my latest thing? So I'm just going to jump to telling you. So for years, I've been in different roles as like a project management consultant, portfolio management consultant, agile coach, you know, those sorts of things. Well, my last client just rebranded me as innovation coach. So I guess that's what I am now.
Bully for you. What is that labor category in a government on a government contract is all I need to know, right? So I can help move that along. Well, congratulations. We'll count on your innovation today. And with us are also three guests, two presenters and a moderator from the upcoming UMD Symposium. You knew that was coming, didn't you? Al Zaytun, a returning guest from about 3 years ago, Marissa Brianza, and Bill Brantley. So how are you, Al? And what is the title of your presentation next month?
I am doing well. Good to be here. And the presentation is going to get us into that experience culture, we call it, right? How that culture enables what we call the strong PM muscle that we're all after the secret sauce for. And I love the title Mike just used. I was so honored to become a PMI fellow in 2019. And then PMI allows you to have these little business cards to go along in case you meet someone important. So long story short, they said, so what title do you want to have on the card? And we talked about a few things and ended up with an idea ambassador, right? So I truly, you know, from what's happening, I think that title stayed with me, and it's the reason why I'm engaged with UMD and those kinds of events. So,
okay, that's what I aspire to be next. Thanks for that.
So now we have a promotion path. You heard it here first, listeners. Excellent. Well, welcome back, Alan. Thank you. And we look forward to what you want to talk about here in PM 4.0 and with that big muscle movement. And Marissa, welcome. And what will you be presenting on?
Hey there. I am going to be presenting on managing AI risks and opportunities. So we all know that AI is more than just a cool technology and awesome algorithms. It definitely does come with complex integration of people, processes, that technology, those models. And although it may seem like magic, it does come with considerable risk. And so in this presentation, me and my colleague are going to be discussing those risks with managing AI projects. And that includes bias, ethical concerns, legal issues, transparency, as well as some strategies to mitigate those risks. And we hope to see you there.
I'm hoping I don't have to run our artwork by you, because I probably will be using DALL-E to make our artwork for the episode. So, you know, but
you might want to be careful.
We'll be careful. We'll be careful. And then Bill, what excitement will you have for us when you're there at the UMD Symposium?
Well, we're going to have 2 days of the federal track. We got some great papers on all kinds of different discussions, including big projects, failed projects in the federal government, and all kinds of new techniques out there. So I was scanning through them real quickly before we came on the show. I don't see anything with AI on it, but I'm expecting to see more AI information probably next year, because I can tell you, I work my day job. I work in the Navy Inspector General's office as a trainer, and there's a lot of interest around contracting in AI. So that might be a new thing to look out for.
I got to tell you, almost anything would be an improvement. And I will say, I think Marissa's got AI embedded in her title on hers. I think it's about managing risks around AI. So they're slipping it in a little bit underneath some other words there for us. But thank you for that. So, yeah, and thank you for taking time on that day to make sure we all are moving along during the symposium. Or actually, it's for the 2 days that you're going to be there. So, listeners, you can sign up for the symposium at pmsymposium.umd.edu. And, you know, something, make sure that you note that you heard it on the podcast. That helps us out when that happens. Come in person or show up virtually. It's all good. It's going to be all good information. So with that, our topic today, PM 4.0, AI and the future of project management. So I personally didn't know we had gotten past 2.0. I was still talking about 2.0 about 6 months ago. So imagine my excitement here. So it's about change, about future, and we're all talking transformation. And it turns out that the technology shifted on us. So with that, let's kick it off here real quick. I think the first thing that I wanted to talk about is we always talk about change and change happening fast and needing to be ready for it. The question I first have is, as project managers, does this actually represent any real change in our environment past the fun stuff?
So I got to ask first, Kendall, what do you mean by the fun stuff?
Oh, I'll tell you something. Today I got to experience a branding meeting a discussion with a branding expert, and he was showing how bad all our websites were by saying all the same kind of things over and over again. And then what was funny is I raised my hand, I said, I think this was all AI generated. And he goes, you got me. Because guess what? It scrapes all the stuff that we all do, and it's the same stuff over and over. The lesson for me was, yeah, if you've heard it before, you get to hear it again. And that's part of the problem with the fun stuff, is where I was at. But I'm intrigued by using it as a PM tool myself. But I understand it comes with some management stuff we need to deal with, maybe in transformation, and then possibly some risks, and then possibly some good coursework we might want to take on it. So with that, I'm going to let you kick off. Who wants to talk about transformation here?
I can tee it up, but you know, I'm not going to get into the sophistication of AI Marissa is going to get into. I mean, even in her intro, she went way over my head, right? So even with a PhD in engineering and everything else, I said, oh, hold tight, Al. No, I think so. I love in your question, though, the piece about speed, right? So you did talk about speed. I think speed is the name of the game in terms of big time changes in the project and program management. Matter of fact, the new terminology we use nowadays in our project teams and so forth, clock speed, right? And the clock really is not our friend, unfortunately, right? Because the reality is the pace by which we're expected to deal with changes, address changes, matter of fact, even deal with the new version of VUCA, I don't know if it's new or not, but, you know, we don't even talk VUCA much anymore. We talk DVUCAD, we call it, right? So we have this, you know, the element of disruption in the front, and we have the diversity at the end, because the reality of the matter is we need to go fast, but we need to be super inclusive. We need ideas, like a ton of them. We need to have diverse views like there's no tomorrow. And with all of that, we need to do this while we are super effective and efficient, you know, and value, of course, is the name of the game. And I'm sure we're going to, in 4.0, we're going to have to talk value. I mean, there's no escaping that. It's funny when you mentioned, though, also in your opening question, 4.0. Yeah, go for it, Mike.
I just want to make sure we had everyone following along, because you guys are already kind of pushing my limits on what I thought I knew, and I'm trying to keep up. So I want to start with something Bill said when we were preparing for this session that might resonate with a lot of PMs out there. He said, just the other day, he used ChatGPT to build a project plan. Let's start with just that as a building block and decide whether we think that would be a great thing for most of us PMs to have and achieve the speed gain that Al was talking about, or whether that freaks us out like we're going to be replaced by robots.
Yeah, and I can actually tell you the exact prompt I used for GPT-4, and I did this last night because I was just trying it out. And I said, create a project plan for building a no-code mobile app that provides leadership training in a micro-learning format. Include scope, risk, resources, and a schedule. And it did a very complex job. I was actually surprised at what it came up with. It came up with a really cool tool name, Project Leader Boost, which I thought, well, that's neat. And it came up with a scope, and it actually tracked a lot of what I would do in a project plan, because I've built apps like this. And I was wanting to see if it could understand all the words I use, what scope was, because the one thing about ChatGPT and AI in general is that they don't really understand things like we do. They do a good simulation of understanding, but do they actually understand these actual concepts? And I actually was talking to my students, because I teach at two different universities, University of Louisville, University of Maryland. And I know they're giving me ChatGPT stuff, because I can tell what is the wording behind that, or what is the meaning behind what you're doing there. So it's a nice trick, and it does get some good information in there. But like with the project plan, it was a good project plan. I would say it was a good start, but I can see some things I needed to put in there.
What form did this come in? I don't imagine it was like a .mpp file.
No, it came into a regular text document. It was nice and bulleted. It was kind of a general overview. So it would have been a good project charter to begin with.
Okay, so maybe a good high-level planning construct, if you will.
Exactly.
So should we be concerned that you can validate that it's a good one and it was generated like that? Are, in fact, all of our project plans so commonly similar?
It does kind of worry me about that. I worked in IT project management, and I'll be very honest, we all templated a lot of stuff. And that's why I'm seeing AI going into contracting, because I used to work as a paralegal also. In the legal field, everything's templated. I mean, I worked in a public defender's office. I worked for the Kentucky Natural Resources Cabinet as an environmental paralegal. And, you know, whenever I had to do something, I just go one of the practice books, pull it off the shelf, and here's my forms, here's my templates. So AI is great if you have templates, and it's pretty, you know, good at giving you the information that's out there that, all, you know, what people always use. What I'm concerned about is if you have to actually do a creative leap, that's what's going to be trouble.
I just wanted to pull on the legal thread just a little bit. I know you guys already heard my preamble about this, but when we're talking about generative AI and chatbots that are generating software code, generating papers and essays, or even making art, we have to be careful. So I am going to add a little bit of the risk factor here is that we have to be careful with things like licensing or plagiarism. And so people and companies are using these AI chatbots and they're pulling together really cool, impressive pieces, but who owns that generated code? Is it the person that typed in the actual request to make the chatbot work? Is it the person that the chatbot actually learned from that gave that code, gave that research? What happens if that information is licensed? Is it pulling from a book that somebody published and they already have restrictions on it? Is it pulling from a code base that has licensing and has, you know, a large amount of payment that's due when you're going to use their code or their product? And I think the big thing that I like to think about here is just that we are responsible for these AI solutions that we create. And I love this quote, and I can never remember who said it, but it's AI is created by humans, and so it should be overseen by humans. And we can't just train and deploy. We have to do our due diligence. This risk management concept is a must. And that's the way that we're going to drive responsibility and make sure that our groups and our teams are practicing and promoting these ideas. And, you know, we're making sure we're designing and developing and deploying AI and thinking critically about the context and the potential and unexpected negative and positive impacts too.
So I hear two things right there, one from Bill and one from you, Marissa. From Bill, I'm hearing, hey, it can get us sort of an 80% head start if we have the expertise to fill in the remaining 20, or at least we know what experts to go to help us fill in the remaining 20. But then I heard from you that the actual source information being aggregated or pulled from might actually have license restrictions. I was under the impression, maybe an incorrect one, that this was all being pulled from stuff in the public domain, but you're saying no.
No. So I think there was recently a news article, I forget what company it was actually using this to generate code. And the training data that they used actually was pulling from every single line of code that was in GitHub.
Does that mean it hacked into people's private code bases in GitHub?
You know, I'm not quite sure, but it's definitely something you have to be careful of. You have to do your due diligence and check those things.
And if I can bring up another point, kind of what she's talking about too, is that with some of these, they're doing deep learning, machine learning. And with machine learning, at some point, you don't know how the machine came up with the ideas or came up with that. And there's just a hidden model there. And I know there's some legal cases about this too, where you have this algorithm maybe doing sentencing calculations or whatever, and you're not sure how it arrived at that conclusion. So not only is it pulling out material that might be licensed, you're not sure how it's coming to its conclusions. There's not a way we can audit that. So that's a little concerning too.
Al, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I'm really intrigued. So I'm not saying what you highlight, Marissa, is not important to me. What I'm worried about next for AI, so this is now, I think, what I'm worried about next is my freedom and my rights as an individual, as a team member, as a program and project manager, and those kinds of elements as well. Because with all the neuro applications and next thing was our earbuds, we're going to have all the AI data on how we think and how we, you know, and that's actually, by the way, is out there, right? It's not like, you know, full public domain, but it's out there, multitude of those applications. I'm really concerned. On one side, I see the future 4.0 project management is all about full autonomy and empowering the team and having the full space to experiment and so forth. And here we go. We could get to a space where we like federating almost the knowledge and the information and the learning and everything else. I don't know if federating the right word, but basically get to a level of extreme hacking, even of the brain, let's say. Right. So I'm really concerned in that regard. But I love what you said. Created by humans should be governed or controlled by humans. Right. So but we really, it's a point in time where our accountability and ownership of what we have around us as enablers like that need to be at the center of what we know what we are using it for. Yeah.
Yeah. I was going to say, I like what Al is saying here. And one of the things I was talking about before is about this whole idea of no code and low code citizen developers. Mm. And, you know, I was in that early and I got to say, Al, you're correct about that. And the tools give you so much power, but it's kind of like in the, you know, the Spider-Man comic books, with great power comes great responsibility. Yep. And I have seen folks build some amazingly complex apps using these tools, but they don't really think about how about network resources? How about the, you know, what are you presenting to the cyber hackers and all that? So there's like, and I like what Marissa said here. It's just, you got to make sure it's governed by humans. There's got to be that human in the loop. And, you know, just not to alarm everyone, but like, you know, I've seen some stories about, you know, these battlefield drones and taking the humans out of the loop. And it's like, no, has anyone here seen Terminator?
Yeah. So, you know, I wanted to pull on both of those threads from Bill and Al. And, you know, one of the risks that always strikes home with me is bias. And people are at the end of these AI solutions. A lot of the decisions that AI solutions are making are going to affect people, whether it is like criminal sentencing, whether we're determining that drone strike, like you're saying, people are at the end of that. And so we have to be very, very, very careful with what we're putting out there. And, you know, AI algorithms rely a lot on the data to learn, and data can be biased, and that leads to biased decision making. And so one of the examples I always like to bring up about this is that automation and AI have always been a key to Amazon's e-commerce dominance. And, you know, one of the funny things is like we respect them a lot for what they do and all the AI that they're using, but they actually created an experimental tool back in, I think, 2015, and it was using AI to rank candidates that were applying to jobs. And so they realized that tool, though, was not rating candidates for software developer roles and some other technical roles in a gender neutral way. The AI solution actually taught itself that male candidates were preferable and penalized resumes that had the word women in it. So like women's chess club champion or like women's AI group leader or something like that. And so they obviously got rid of that program and like admitted to their mistakes, which is amazing. But we have to know that these things are bound to happen. We all have our inherent biases, and that's in our data. And so we have to be proactive. We have to care. We have to take the time to check these things out and be honest and upfront when we suspect something's bad to happening.
I hear the new movie, How to Train Your AI, has got to be coming here soon. Al, you had your hand up, then Mike.
Just very briefly, like very quick comment, and a plug it for my session as well. You know, the whole that's why culture is so important, right? I mean, at the end of the day, the Amazons of the world and others as well, you know, again, if they are not super careful about creating the right culture to enable the utilization of technology like that in the right place, you know, Peter said what? Peter Drucker, right, Peter? Culture eats strategy for breakfast, right? So the reality is even more so, not in any cheesy way into the future. We got to be very keen on creating the right culture in which this notion of the 4.0 technology can create the right values, can create the right drivers, can create the right focus in our organization. So I'm really hopeful that the balance is there. Culture, strategy, and the right enablers come together.
Yeah, I wanted to kind of frame things in a way that I'm starting to hear you all describe, and that is, it's not really man versus machine. It's man the expert versus man the toolmaker. And let's not to say man, but human, right? And so I remember when it became not just interesting that a computer beat the, you know, the best chess masters in the world, but when it started happening every single time. A chess master would almost never beat the computer, right? And it was like, oh my God, computers are taking over. But I remember reading articles like, no, we just got better and better at making tools to play chess. And so I wanted to put that out there to the group here. Say, what do you make of, you know, the culture and, you know, human in the loop and all these other things when it comes to, you know, man, humans, the experts versus humans, the tool makers?
Yeah, and this is a great point you bring up. And I know Kasparov was part of that. And you remember Deep Blue beating him. But there was another tournament. He talked about this in Harvard Business Review about it was a open tournament worldwide, and it was computers or amateurs. And the eventual winners of the tournament was, they had these two amateurs, pretty highly ranked amateurs, but, you know, basically not world class, but pretty good. But they had three different computers with them. And what they would do is they would use the computers, see what they came up with. Then they would put the human in the loop, came up with some kind of conceptual ideas. And that's my whole thing with this. And if I can plug one of my courses, it's on digital transformation. I look at the human side, and I see with AI, it's great. We shouldn't have it replace the project managers, but it's a great tool to augment a lot of things. It can help us augment our scheduling and help us with our resource management and working together. So I kind of like not man versus machine, but man plus machine or human plus machine, and augmenting some of that. So when I look at this with ChatGPT, it's great for going out there and collecting all this information and telling me stuff and summarizing. So it saves me a lot of time reading. But again, at the end, I'm going to be editing what it does because there's some, it's just not creative. It doesn't have that conceptual thinking that humans excel in.
I liked your comment about augmented there. And that's the outcome there is they found out that the teams that are augmented are the ones that are best off. And, you know, we have augmented reality, virtual reality. I'm thinking of our AI right now as like virtual intelligence. is kind of there, but not really. What we're actually after is augmented intelligence, right? That's the AI we're probably after there, and I'm thinking in that context. But I liked your question, Mike, around what is the role of culture on that. The thought I had was coming from traditionally we talk about project managers that 90% of it is communication. It wasn't about running the Gantt charts or the earned value. You have to know your tool set. You got to use your tool set in the right types of projects. We've had many podcasts on R&D, doesn't fit any of that. You got the agile waterfall thing going on, all that going on, right? But it turns out we always claim it's about the interactions of humans, the identification of stakeholders, being able to communicate with them and genuinely communicate, which then we're always told is really about listening. So to me, that brings up an interesting question with anyone using generative AI or even summarizing AI. And Al, I want to go to you because your presentation highlighted the future of business is human, projectized, and digitized. And I'm like, dude, you got human and digitized in the same set of pillars there.
No, that, I love both your comments and Bill's comment as well. And you know, if I summarize how Bill's point resonated with me, Bill, it's really, to me, it's the balance, right? So the balance is the name of the game, right? So I think at some point, and maybe even in the book, we talked about, you know, the next gen, we talked about the human equation almost, right? And that equation does have, you know, I think it's 2.0, not a 4.0 equation, just taking the human one step. Maybe the human is not quite ready for a 4.0. But the reality is, what I find amazing, and I'm glad, Kendall, you mentioned the communication aspect. We are not there yet. This is the bizarre thing. How common sense has it been from the inception of this whole notion of this profession, from the investments and the changes, PMI, talking finally value and all the kinds of, you know, breakthroughs, let's call it, in the profession, until today? I mean, literally this week, I was at an event as well where I can find that communication does not cascade in the organization the right way, does not go across, does not go down. It is hindered by the very classic, back to the human and the culture piece of the equation, right? All those barriers that we still have, that we have not broken down in our organizations. How in the world? So to me, the way I can really have this, you know, as you talked about that nice big title, it is down to the basics of the ones I adore, like the Brené Browns of the world. I mean, the more technologically savvy we become, the more hungry we should be to get into the space of emotional intelligence and to really master that like no other muscle that we have in the organization. Or at the very least, we need, the more we know and the more we have at our disposal technology-wise and AI applications, et cetera, the more humble we need to be. Because in the reality, okay, so we have already the mastery, let's call it, from data and analytics and everything else. Okay, so what is our value proposition? Why do we even exist at that point? Well, it exists because we can relate, we can connect, we can energize, we can put the fire underneath, back to the point about speed where we started our journey, right? Where we can really get to that clock speed in terms of delivery and delivering the right things and questioning things. My favorite guy of all when it comes to leadership concepts is John Maxwell. And John is as simple as it gets in terms of his ideas and concept. I love the man. And he gets into what's called a very simple principle. For me, I take that as a PM, what's called mark your calendar. Mark your calendar is simply just like it sounds. Like, we need to be totally existent and aware of the moment where we are on an ongoing basis, day in, day out. Look at our calendar, where we're spending our time, and how much of that time is value add time. If it's not, let's rethink. In our world of projects, of course, as Bill was talking about templates and all that, that's the lessons learned, maybe retrospectives and all that fun stuff. But the reality is, we are at a moment of truth here to face the changes around us and say, okay, world is disrupted, work is disrupted, technology is going to explode even more so at a speed we've never even imagined before. So what is my value contribution, and what's my role? What's my title? I don't think the future is going to have project managers. As much as I love project management and project managers as a concept, I think we need to figure out a fully new set of titles, roles, and a complete different value proposition for that profession.
Well, we have ambassador, innovator, and booster on the call today, apparently. So we are desperately seeking these terms, and I think we'll know in hindsight when we finally landed on them. But yeah, to the extent that part of the complexity of project management was around sequencing and dependencies and actually understanding things, that seems to be something that the efficiency of a model could help with. But to the extent it was communication and the fact that one pissed off person can blow your project up, we have a whole new bundle of things there. But Marissa, hop in on this. What do you think? What the human touch side of it, not just from the risk perspective, but what's your take on it as a data scientist?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, I kind of look at it from both lenses, both from a AI practitioner as well as a project manager. And so the thing that I like to keep in mind is that the AI field is always evolving. It's always changing. And as a PM and as a tech lead, I have the responsibility to continuously learn, keep my skills up to date, evolve with it, and make sure my team and clients are in the know. And that means that they need to understand the challenges, the risks. They need to understand how we're developing, how we're operationalizing. And those are some of the most important things. And then one of the things that I like to use as well is like vulnerability. I think vulnerability is super, super key to making sure that you're successful just in general consulting, and then specifically when you're in technical consulting. You have to embrace humility and selflessness and transparency. And so there's this book that I really, really love. It's called, bear with me, Getting Naked.
I love that book.
Good. Yeah, it's by
Patrick Lencioni.
Thank you. Yes, yes. And so he talks about these three big fears that we have to get over, to be vulnerable and like maximize this trust and the confidence we're getting from our clients. So we have to, you know, get over the fear of losing business. We have to tell the truth. We have to consult, never just sell. We have to stop being embarrassed. We have to be okay with making mistakes and owning up to them and asking questions that, you know, may feel dumb per se. And we have to, you know, get over the fear of being inferior and, you know, help the client with where they are at. They're not always ready for the big, hard AI conversations of, I'm going to use this deep neural network. You know, maybe they're just like, hey, do we have the right data? Is this the data we should be using? You have to meet them on their level. And so this book is, you know, really relatable, not only for project management, but AI project management as well, because we have to bring this vulnerability to the practice of AI. We have to make sure that they understand what we're doing and break down those boundaries, level the playing field, so that way they come on this journey with us.
I love that, Marissa, and I want to take it a level deeper with everyone here if we can, especially if you're not familiar with this book or you're potentially turned off by the title, right? This notion, and by the way, quick aside, I was reading it because I was part of an executive leadership team that all decided to read it, and I hadn't read it yet, and I was getting on the plane to get to the meeting, and so I really, it's not a long book, so I figured I could just read it all on the plane. But I didn't think about the fact that I'd be holding up a book in public called Getting Naked. And sure enough, you know, there was a woman who was assigned a seat next to me and looked quite nervous that she was going to be sitting next to this guy with this book. But all of that, you know, sort of funny book title stuff aside, I do highly recommend it. I don't have any stock in Patrick Lencioni's company, if he even has a company. But this notion that Marissa brings up, I think, is so interesting in an AI context or in any context, that it's about making yourself vulnerable as a trust builder. It's about being humble, or, you know, showing up with appropriate humility. Even if you are the smartest person in the room, you don't have all, you know, you don't have a full monopoly on all knowledge in the room, right, by definition. And so that notion that, you know, you show up humble, you show up vulnerable, you show up human. And that could be a really valuable counterweight to a lot of this sort of, you know, accelerating automation and AI and algorithms and all the rest of us, all the rest of stuff going on around us.
Yeah, and I really like where this is going, and I like the idea of the vulnerability piece. In one of my first books, and this was all my experiences as an IT project manager, where I was telling people to do things, and they did something totally opposite. It's like, did you not understand me? And I started going into, yeah, you're right, communication is very important. And I just started going into, well, what the heck is understanding? So I actually researched that, wrote a book on it. And I think that's one of the things that the AI misses here, is that, you know, as Marissa was talking about, and as Al was talking about, we have to see other people, and the AI doesn't see us, because there's just no, not now, maybe some years from now, there's no theory of the mind. When we are out there talking to other folks, we can imagine ourselves in that person's space, maybe that person, how they would react, you know, the whole idea of mirror neurons. And there's a great theory out there, it's been around since the 70s, called coordinated management of meaning. I use that a lot in my project management. And the concept is making sure that everyone understands on a deep level what we're trying to accomplish here. And I actually kind of broke it down to an understanding triad: know what, know how, and know why. And right now, AI can know what pretty well. I'm not sure if it knows how yet, and I know it doesn't know why. So when I see the responses come up, it's like, you know, and they're very good puppets. It's very good puppets there. And You know, and there's a problem in philosophy. I'm going to go off into a real deep one here. It's called the zombie problem. And this is not The Walking Dead, but more like, does this AI have an inner world? Does it have something where it has a conscience? Does it understand the world? And it can do a great simulation of that, but it doesn't. So that's, again, why I come to, don't let AI replace you. You can use it to augment you, but you still need that human in the loop.
You know, interesting, especially with like self-driving cars and this sort of thing, the ethicists among us, and certainly touching upon that side of this closely here, AI may well be better at driving than the average human being, especially given how distracted we can be. And, you know, we have good days and bad, and sometimes we're tired and, you know, on and on and on. And that it learns. So if you're heading right for what looks like a bunch of cars crossing in front of you, but it's actually a bridge and you're about to go under that bridge, AI can learn that that's not actually, you know, going to become an accident if you're going under the bridge. But the ethicists say, if you're in an impossible, you know, facing an impossible choice of going straight and knocking over an elderly person, or swerving and knocking over the woman with the baby stroller, what, you know, and you have 0.2 seconds to make that decision. That's number one. I don't think we want AI making that sort of moral choice or driven by ethical values, et cetera. But then what do we want AI to do? Right? We don't want it to do nothing, I presume. We want it to do something. Like, because if we freeze, then our choice is made for us. So I want to throw that out there to the group.
Yeah, so I'll take that a little bit because I also wanted to. So I was so happy. It's always good when you get with a bunch of folks like this group here, lots of great insights. And when you took us to vulnerability, Marissa, I think that's really fantastic, because at the end of the day, I do believe that's going to be part of the secret sauce to interact with AI. I really do believe that. And then, of course, you had to take me to good old Pat. You know, Pat Lencioni, he's a master. Not just, you know, I have not read the one you and Mike talked about. But, you know, he's the same guy who had a book by the name Death by Meetings, right? And I was in a meeting earlier today, and they said, Al, we're so tired of this virtual world. Are there tricks? Well, I said, well, let's go check out Pat. But, and he was before his time, and he continues to be. Matter of fact, this is not a plug-in for Pat, but he also had what's called the working genius, right? And he has a multitude of those that I believe, if we dig into some of the insights there as well, it's going to influence the kind of a leader we need to have in the future in terms of how he or she will interact with technology differently. So, Mike, to go directly to your last point, though, I love AI for creating space. For me, if AI is going to succeed, it allows me to have this the most valuable commodity that we're losing day in, day out, which is time, right? To me, AI equals time. If I can really, truly find ways by which I can buy the time to think, to collaborate, back to the point about communication, to really spend time as a human in a spaces where AI will not potentially go there, and be very clear what those swim lanes are, I'm going to be a much more effective leader. That's what I'm excited about the most when it comes to AI.
Well, let's talk about where that might be then. We've all experienced project management and project managers, teaching and training around them and suffering it. I imagine most of us were on teams before we got to be project managers. Where would we see that time beyond the 80% solution for initial startup information, like the beginning of a charter? So we'll take that as the beginning of coming out of the blocks. But I'm thinking people worry about replacing people's work, which I think has actually always happened. So that goes way back. So that's going to happen. It just means people will do different work. But to that point around the time, where would we see that in typical, traditional, agile project management environments, anywhere? Where are we going to start seeing that? Where should our listeners start thinking, I want to learn more about this because I see where I could use it to get that speed or to reduce maybe some roadblocks that equal speed. So let's think about that for just a second. Where would we see that time increase at a project level?
Yeah, I can take that one. So one of the most interesting things I've been reading about of like AI enhanced project management is actually the notion of a project assistant. And so not necessarily doing the project for you or even replacing you as a project manager, but you know, having a repository of like actions that you've made in the past, decisions you've made in the past, and be able to use something like a ChatGPT to kind of scrape through your memory that sometimes can be foggy as we get older, and be able to pull those decisions back for us of like, hey, you know, I asked Johnny to develop a database and deploy it like a year ago. I forgot how long it takes to do that. So I use my little project assistant and say, hey, I'm building a database. Can you give me a project timeline for that? And it goes back into my archives and says, hey, you know, last time it took about 2 weeks. Here were the task breakdowns. Here was what was accomplished. Here were the challenges. And so it's something that actually can like dig into your knowledge, your expertise as a project manager and kind of give you your own insights back to you.
Augmented memory. How many of us remember all the phone numbers we had as a kid? Do you remember you used to have to memorize phone numbers? That wasn't even AI. And now I know exactly one phone number, my own, which is, I don't think, very helpful.
Well, sometimes I don't, actually. It depends on if I travel internationally, I have an additional phone number.
For PMs of a certain age, Al. Yeah, Bill.
Yeah, you know, I was actually thinking about this last week because I'm working in a team and we have about 15, 20 projects going on at one time. And I was trying to teach my folks the idea of dependencies and a lot of interdependencies in our projects. And I was thinking it would be great to have an AI that could keep track of our dependencies and actually kind of run through simulations for me, maybe on Monte Carlo, whatever, and figure out maybe the best way that we can sequence our activities. So it's not really inside the project, but sequence in our programs, the different activities, because, then again, there's that communication thing and that coordination, that piece, the coordination and communication piece. And I thought if each of our projects had an AI that could talk to the other project AIs, it would be great if they could figure out my dependency schedule and the optimum path I need.
Yeah, I love that. So Bill, two things. So one, I'm going to have an ask for us after our time together today, because Ricardo, a very good friend of mine, you know, who's a big fan of ChatGPT, and he actually, speaking of dependencies, he actually used ChatGPT to test whether or not it could create a proper critical path. And it was actually, the answer was wrong. So, and it was a very basic one. So I was on the sideways challenge for us. But I love your point about dependency at large. If AI and part of that learning and building on what Marissa mentioned, if that, you know, like from a project assistant or from utilization of the learning over time, it used to be intimidating for me as a young project manager. And I would imagine that continues to be the case when you are in a space where you have no expertise. You're coming in and you're trying to help this, you know, new manufacturing team in an industry you've never operated in before, et cetera. And here you are coming in as the expert. Hey, help us develop our plan and detailed schedule and this and that. You don't have that expertise, but guess what? With AI, you're expediting the entire journey. If you have the logic, if you have the way to pull the information, to work with people, and then utilize that expertise that's right there for you, I think not only the learning curve, but the effectiveness by which I can play my role could be just like that, right? Because that is super intimidating, especially the younger, you know, next gen kind of individuals getting into the space. I can only see, you know, a bright future if AI is put in the right space and not, of course, handling all the risks and other threats we talked about in the mix here.
So when Kendall and I get together sometimes over bourbons, we have conversations about this kind of thing.
I can either confirm or deny that.
I can speak to my own preference for bourbons. But anyway, we often talk about, okay, fast forward, you know, 50 years or whatever. What does AI really look like for work and for business and for professional activity? And Kendall, you've made the assertion that, you know, given that so many of our organizations that have, you know, big hierarchies built up, that the individual functional business units too often make locally optimal decisions that actually might harm the company overall, that maybe that's the thing that's going to get replaced by AI, all the vice presidents, right? And so that we actually have an AI that's attuned to the system-wide goal, right, of maximizing profit or whatever the organization's goal is. I'm curious what this panel might think of that.
Oh, I love that. I'm all over that. I mean, matter of fact, I didn't even use the exact words like you nicely put it, but like when Marissa mentioned that, it's really fantastic because I used to always say, oh, I don't have enough people, I don't have enough team. Well, guess what? No matter how high I go in the organization, with part of AI, I'm creating all those bunch of assistants, right? And I can give them number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, right? I'm extending the team. I'm getting rid of, you know, some of the bureaucracy potentially. That's maybe where you're taking some of this, Mike. I'm loving that aspect. We do need to find a way by which we rethink. Remember how I mentioned that earlier about culture. Rethinking very clearly our value proposition. Why we exist. I mean, Bill said it nicely in the what and the how and the why, but the big question for us going forward in organizations and our roles in this whole profession, why do we exist, right? It's not a threat.
So you say it's not a threat, but I want to ask Marissa. Marissa sees some downsides in all of this. So where are the gotchas hiding?
She's all about risk, isn't she?
Marissa.
I don't know. So it's very interesting. I think culture is an interesting one. And honestly, the culture around AI and data science and like all the technical communities, I've always loved, to be honest. The culture around this is just such a positive and like transparent place that like, you know, I can put away my like risk hat for a little bit and just kind of like celebrate kind of where we are today and all of the different little communities that are doing big things in AI. So in that aspect, I'm actually like a firm believer and cheerleader for AI.
What about the fact that we have no more executive committees? It's just a bunch of CEO assistants.
Questionable. I think you always need somebody that like has a vision and like has that like oomph, that woo factor that's like leading a company or leading a group into the future. So I don't think you fully get away from like executive leadership. I think it might just look a little bit different.
Marissa, only if they cascaded down. Remember, I mentioned earlier, we have a challenge in cascading back to the communication. That vision sitting in a nice little strategy or strategic plan and a bunch of metrics and KPIs and everything else that does not cascade, they do me no good.
Yeah. And I like what you're saying, Mike, about the local Optima. And one of the things I think another technology can pair with AI is the idea of digital twins. And when I was in the federal government, one of the things I was trying to push was having federal twins of federal agencies, because I'm not going to point any fingers at any agencies, but there's a lot of local Optima, like my department's running great. I don't know what your problem is. And the agency as a whole suffers. And like I said one time in a meeting, you know what? The Titanic had a wonderful catering department. How'd that help?
Yeah.
Okay. You know, so it's the same.
So idea. Wait. Yeah. So I'm not as familiar with this term digital twin. So are you saying we should clone the FBI?
Yes. Why not? I mean, a software simulation of the FBI. And where I came from with this is when I was office personnel management, we were doing strategic workforce planning. And I thought, well, let's just simulate the federal workforce in the software and look at how we can digitize it and how we can run it through simulations and see what would be the optimum path here, and look at the global optimum instead of the local.
So how does the digital twin help with that?
Mike, come on. And my daily bread with Siemens, all our work is about digital twin. I mean, that's the whole idea, is that the efficiencies we create with technology are massive. Digital twin literally is the ability to create a replica from whatever it is that you want to create. You could even create a replica of, you know, the mix of ingredients that go into creating a new flavor of a coffee, for example, right? You can use digital twin to enable you to, instead of the massive testing an automotive industry player wants to do in terms of rethinking their safety processes, etc., you can completely, without investing a penny that sacrifices, you know, human life or gets you to sacrifice concerns about your brand, etc., you're able to almost create a replica of whatever it is you want to roll out to your customers and to your users and so forth. So without getting super technical, because that's not our podcast, in a nutshell, that's really what it creates.
Yeah, but hang on, I'm going to stick with this, because if I haven't heard the term digital twin, I'm certain there are people in our listening audience who have also not heard of it. And this notion of having two FBIs where I think one might be sufficient is kind of scary.
That's a different story, but it's a great story, I thought, from Bill.
No, he's using it for simulation. You're using it for simulation.
That's what I'm getting the sense of. Are we talking about a digital twin that I can use as a sounding board?
Absolutely. It's like
okay.
Some commercial products out there like SimCity, SimEarth. You know, there's a whole series of products out there that you can use and, you know, that you can simulate. And some of these games that we have out there, like Call of Duty and all that, that's basically a simulation. And you can run different scenarios. And just like Al was talking about, you can do it without hurting people. And they do that in manufacturing. They do two digital twins of aircraft, and they put it through stress testing and such to see what would happen if this had, you know, had happened. So my whole idea here is with the agency itself, if we're doing certain policies, we're doing some kind of strategic workforce planning or some kind of HR policy, we can run it through our digital twin and have the AI basically simulate these folks for us.
Okay. So it's kind of like you can run what if scenarios and mm-hmm. And kind of check against your current thinking, check your assumptions.
On steroids.
Got it. Okay.
I'm intrigued along with something else that we talked about on the nature of work changing. I'm thinking historically here. Every time there's a major shift in tools, I'm thinking of the old guard, which might be some of us on the call, or kind of like, you know, in my day, we had to calculate the earned value or the critical path. You know, now these youngsters, they get away with all that, right? But what we have found, I think, in of late with some of the technologies that have rolled out since I've been around, is that, in fact, the kids don't know a lot of the stuff that I had to learn in high school and college, or kids or just younger people generally. But they know different stuff, newer stuff, raised with different tools. So they actually think differently and act differently, which sometimes in our popular culture, we assign value or devalue in some ways, in different ways, right? But the point is, they're already operating at a level that is very different, in a lens that is very different. I'm wondering, in the project management space, will we be solving different problems? And what can we be thinking about there? And what got me thinking with this is, Al, is your comment about the calculation of the critical path being wrong, which kind of takes me to Marissa. I think maybe a question Marissa might be able to answer for me. Is that because the AI we've been talking about isn't actually calculating? As soon as you said that, what I thought was, oh, because it went out and scraped the universe for all the project plans, and most people can't calculate it right. So it returned, because remember what's returning often, or at least the ChatGPT that aspect is, seems to be returning the common practice, the distilled most common practice. And it just made me think, oh, most of us take the test and get it wrong 10 times. So there's 10 times more bad answers out there than good answers. But nonetheless, it got me thinking, who's going to be bothering with this in the future? So what is the new work that this begins to elevate the newer workers? What does a project even begin to look like in the future? When you think about it as risk and dependencies, we've talked about comms and stakeholder analysis a bit. It's fit for value. We talked about project management as a value engine, or an engine for producing value. Where does this begin to play for us now? Is it taming our AI is what the project manager does? Is it an AI manager?
That's an interesting question. I know we talked about, you know, what our different titles should be. I think we still just use the plain, boring ones. You know, I'm a task lead in some senses. Sometimes I'm a project manager. Sometimes I'm a program manager. But any of the same. I think my role just becomes pushing people down the right path and making sure that they are doing the best work that they can possible, making sure that they're having that vulnerability, making sure that they're being transparent, and, you know, just making sure that we are providing the best value for our customer. So it goes back to the, like, consulting, not selling piece of getting naked. The question that you asked before about where are we going in the future, like now that we're here, you know, AI is getting problems wrong or it's not answering something correctly. I think where I'd like to see more research in the AI field is in model explainability. And so knowing why a model makes predictions the way it does, and it's essential. It goes a long way for building that trust and enhancing that transparency, because AI models can be black boxes, but they shouldn't be, you know. While we might know that a model has more accuracy and it can tell the difference between, you know, a tank or a truck, we might not know why it knows that difference. And so there has been research in this field. I think it is growing. There's some new tool called LIME. I forgot what that stands for, but it's dedicated to explaining what machine learning models are doing, and, you know, gives us explanations for, you know, like text classifiers or image classifiers and things like that. And so I think that's one field that I think is going to explode in the next couple of years.
That's pretty awesome. You know, interesting. So I'll make two quick comments. One, titles, you talk titles, and do a plug-in for University of Maryland and the course on edX. I think the course title is Program Management Enabling Value-Driven Change. And I did use the title Change Scientists, right? So the change scientist, to me, is pretty much at the core of the project manager and program manager of the future, right? I mean, that's really what we're doing. We're driving change, but we got to be scientists. Whether you look at the data side, whether you look at how much you can enable technology to help you. But I want to shift to, even when you said old guards and earned value and those kinds of things, Kendall, that's all being disrupted, right? I mean, mm-hmm. I can't really stand with a straight face and be saying, hey, where is your earned value data, et cetera, without really focusing on what matters, what we measure into the future, how we define success, what success looks like, is disrupted day in, day out. And a plug in to Kirzner, and I love the guy, great authority. He has a maturity curve. Actually, he takes PM now to 5.0, so kind of like an interesting space. And excuse me, and that's really the strategic metrics, right? He takes us beyond the value metrics into what he calls the intangibles, because really intangibles, and that's a great differentiator between us and AI anyhow, and then into the space of truly strategic metrics. You know, finding out what is that right mix that allows us to take PM to the strategic muscle that it needs to be in terms of, you know, the whole shifts we've seen in the project economy, product, program economy, whatever you want to call it. And that is a future that I don't think AI has a small place to play. I think it's going to be front and center.
Yeah, this whole conversation leads me to something that I think is near and dear to us project managers, which is the triple constraint. And if we think about what the triple constraint is and why we've always used it, it's something that actually can be calculated, right? Trade-offs between scope, schedule, and cost, which is, call it the cost side of the equation, in order to maximize the value side, right? Mm-hmm. And I think too often we as PMs forget that the purpose is to maximize the value side. And we're just doing trade-offs almost like on gut feel or something. And of course, the value side, one of the reasons that engineers and PMs have had a hard time with it is because it's hard to measure, hard to quantify, and it's changing all the time, right? It's in the eye of the beholder. And if you're targeting a product at a million beholders, when those beholders have alternatives with your competitors, et cetera, and all that's changing, it's just a really hard thing to calculate and keep up with. But that's the true human side of it.
Yeah.
And the part that it's think AI would have a difficult time keeping up with. It might help us aggregate everyone's, you know, current sense of what they value, but it certainly can't tell us what that is, right? It has to interrogate real human beings to understand what those human beings really value, whether it's a product or, you know, better military health care or veteran health care or whatever our agencies are there to do. So I wonder if you guys can comment on that.
Yeah. And you're getting a great point here. And it's something we're seeing in training now. But one of my favorite authors is Mark Schwartz. And I remember reading his book on the Art of Business Value, which is a great read. And he spends his whole time trying to determine what is business value. And he finally kind of punts in the end. He says, well, business value is what businesses value. And I thought, well, great. So I wrote your whole book for this. But you're right. With project management, it's no more about being able to do the triple constraint and all that and being able to do the easily measured stuff. It's the value that we produce. And I remember when Kirzner talked at one of our symposiums about that, and he just said, this is what the future of project management is going to be about, the value. And it kind of struck home with me because I remember one time I almost got fired because I did a project that was brought in on time, brought in on under budget, and, you know, was perfectly done according by project management methods. But my boss said, well, what's the value to the client? There's no
value.
Yeah, it's useless to them. So when, you know, we talk about that, and when I'm seeing work with digital transformation, and you're right, this, you know, that this is where AI can help us, but it can't conceive for us what we're trying to achieve with the digital transformation, because the old purpose is to bring that organization to a new level to deliver a new kind of value to its customers.
So that sounds like where PMs have to be focused going forward.
Right.
Let's use the tools to do the cost side, which is maybe where we were overly focused.
Right.
And
like you said, value is such an elusive concept, and AI is just, I don't think an AI can determine what value is. I mean, we can ask ChatGPT to define value for me, but does it really know? And it has to have that theory of mind and has to understand what the stakeholders want in value.
I got to tell you, the stakeholders as clients often don't know. And they're the ones that own it.
Sure.
So that is really interesting about focusing on the value. I'm thinking, Mike, oddly enough, just like every podcast, it walked us a little bit back to the theory of constraints. It doesn't help us to speed up and be more efficient at the wrong parts of the model.
Yeah,
right?
And it's funny.
We got to get to the value side.
Kendall, I was having such a hard time as Mike started talking and then Bill built on it. And then here you go, you as well. You know, I was starting to laugh to two things. So, Mike, to your point about the constraints, it sounds like you got a preview of my presentation, because there is an actual slide that shows how the constraints exploded. But then the other one is actually very interesting. I recently contributed something called Confessions of a Project Manager.
Uh-oh.
So to Bill's point, I think we should make sure that's provided to our audience and listeners, et cetera. It's a phenomenal list of different, you know,
practitioners. So now I'm going to ask, did you generate 80% of those confessions from ChatGPT?
No, I had a real confession right smack into the topic all three of you just mentioned, which is really, it doesn't matter if you think it was successful. And I have a great story there that I share there. I'm not going to share it here now, but it's really something that project managers.
Okay, so to hear this cool story, you have to go see Al's presentation at UMD next month.
So I'm gonna take us home here real quick. So here's the last thing, since we keep prognosticating around all of this. If you remember, 2023, just 5 years ago, was 2018. I keep thinking 5 years is a long time. It feels like forever, but actually 2018 was like yesterday, right? I mean, I don't know where you were just 5 years ago, but think 2018. That was just not that long ago. So let's project forward 2028. So I need to know your one projection, your one prediction for the world of project management in 2028. What's it going to look like for someone who's graduating college this year and going to start the progress, accidentally becoming a project manager in about 2 years, getting on a team, and suddenly finds herself a project manager in 2028. What's it going to look like? What's she got to know? What's she got to do? What's she going to be using? What's it going to look like?
I don't want to steal yours, Marissa. You go first.
Yeah. Oh, man. Okay. So I think the project assistant is going to be a legit real thing. So I think you're going to be a PM and you're going to have your digital assistant. And then I still think it'll be heavy community based. And that's how you're going to get to tomorrow. I still think we'll have like agile project management. I think that will be the way of the future still. But I think we will definitely be augmented with machines and not replaced by machines by any means.
Augmented agile, the hot next take. Thing to sell and put up on a website. Build it and they will come. Thank you very much. Who wants to go next?
I mean, I started with Idea Ambassador. I don't know where I can go from there. But at the end of the day, I would say my wish that I've started this whole journey is I think can be accomplished in 5 years, which is the PMs are going to be the CEOs of organizations, every single one of them 5 years from now. And they are going to be doing that only because they've empowered themselves with the power of AI and technology.
Okay, so I'm going to go out here on a limb for you, and I have seen some research in artificial emotional intelligence machines.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Say it isn't so.
Yeah, and they're going to be bringing emotional intelligence. So I see in 5 years, as a project manager and a program manager, you're going to be dealing with an augmented team, and you're going to have some AI with some rudimentary, maybe empathy skills, maybe some emotional skills.
Yep.
And you're going to have to kind of learn AI psychology and how to deal with them. Because we've seen some experiments with some of the AIs that have gotten nasty.
We better rethink education and universities pretty soon, because everything you're talking about does not exist as we speak, as widespread. Yeah.
Well, you know, I was surprised when ChatGPT exploded out there like last November. So, you know, but the way this is the pace, this is exponential growth now. So I can see artificial intelligence with emotions.
So you're all saying that we're going to go from management 2.0 to management 4.0 to management 16.0.
I think we're exactly. Counting is what we're saying, Mike. There's no counting capable of catching up.
And if you remember Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, you know, Marvin the Paranoid Android, we're going to be dealing with that.
Thanks.
The power of management will double every 18 months.
Mm-hmm.
There you go. So with that, I'm going to ask you guys, how can our listeners get hold of you? Al, tell us about that. How can they follow you, find out what you're writing about, what you're thinking, besides going to the PM Symposium at UMD?
Thank you. Very quickly, LinkedIn is the way to go. So you can find me on LinkedIn. Al Zaytoon, for sure. You can find me there on LinkedIn. Straightforward. You can definitely check out some of the work I've done over the years. I'm a big fan of PM World Journal, Project Management World mm-hmm. Journal. Lots of tons of publications there all the time. A lot of series, especially with Harold Kirzner. Speaking of Harold, the book PM Next Gen, The Key Enablers or Pillars for the Future of Organizational Excellence, that came out last year with Harold and Ricardo Vargas. And yeah, looking forward to seeing you at the conference. That's going to be that a great symposium this year.
Thank you. Marissa?
You can always find me on LinkedIn. I'm probably the only Marissa Brienza, so feel free to drop that in the search and you'll find me. And then for any other yarn lovers, you'll always catch me at a local yarn store.
That's another episode.
That is cool. So yeah, I'm on LinkedIn, and also I'm all Red X. So I'm going to be launching my 12th course on citizen development training, and it's going to be April 15th, if everything goes well. And then I'm working on a new one called AHA, which is the Agile, Healthy, and Attractive Organization. So you're going to see a lot of the concepts we talked about today in that. So LinkedIn, EdX, that's a great way to get a hold of me.
We may have very different concepts of beauty if you're talking about the attractive agile organization.
Place where you want to work.
Culture.
And Mike, same old LinkedIn?
Same old LinkedIn. You'll find me there. There are like 8 or 10 Mike Hannons in the world, but I think I'm the only one that cares about project portfolios.
Oh, well, I'm going to leave it there for us today. What I heard today was AI really means augmented memory, augmented intelligence, and augmented emotional intelligence. Oh my goodness. A brave new world indeed. Populated with such software as this. So with that, I think we will sign off. I did want to say thank you to everyone today for giving us your time and organizing this so quickly. And I think it's going to be exciting to hear the more in-depth presentations you have over each of the different topics that you have. So I do appreciate that very much. So thank you. PMPs, if you've listened to this whole episode, go get yourself a PDU at PMI's PD Reporting Center, selecting online or digital media. And Manually enter provider code 4634 and select Empowered Strategies. And the name of the episode is PMPOV0108 PM 4.0 AI and the Future of PM. And select the ways of working in the new talent triangle. I am Kendall Lott, having passed the Turing test, reminding you to register for the limited in-person seats at the 2023 UMD Symposium at pmsymposium.umd.edu and to come and shake hands in the flesh. And until next time, keep it real and keep it in scope and get it done.